Scaredy Cats, welcome to the Haunted Library. I'm Sherry.
And I'm Ryan.
So we've talked about it on so many different occasions. We are both huge fans of haunted house stories, whether they are in book form, whether they're in movie form. And since it's October, Halloween is just around the corner. We wanted to talk about one of our favorite haunted house novels. It's a book so scary that prepare to drink, for those of you who have been following along. Stephen King has actually described it as one of the most important horror novels of the 20th century. It is an absolute classic, and it's inspired a play. It's inspired two movies, one which is incredible, the other which is not so much, and a Netflix series, which also is absolutely incredible, although it takes a completely different turn, but it's so good. So grab yourself a seasonal beverage. Ryan, what's your favorite seasonal beverage for fall?
My favorite seasonal beverage, it's an adult beverage. So it's bourbon, apple cider, a little bit of ginger ale, and a little bit of lemon juice stirred together with a cinnamon stick garnish. It's wonderful.
Ooh, that sounds like the perfect drink to have during this time of year. What do you have a name for it?
No, it probably has a name, but I never learned it.
Well, as of now, we're calling it the Eleanor.
Oh, the Eleanor. I love that. Yeah, we're going to keep that.
Perfect. So grab yourself an Eleanor, curl up under your favorite blanket, and get cozy because it is time to talk about Shirley Jackson's The Haunting of Hill House.
Yay.
I'm really excited to talk about this book.
Oh, me too. And before we hit record, I was telling you that this will actually be the third time on a podcast that I've talked about this book specifically. So it's pretty great, pretty special.
Oh, I love it. I think this is only the first time I've talked about it. We've both read it multiple times. And you have like the super fancy edition of it as well.
I have, I think, three or four editions of this book. This is the one book where it's like, I'm not really a book collector. Like when it comes to Stephen King, drink. I don't collect like first editions, all hardbacks or anything like that, because I know that's such an expensive habit. But for The Haunting of Hill House, I make an exception. And occasionally I'll kind of splurge on like a really cool vintage copy. So yeah, that one that was recently put out by the Folio Society, beautiful illustration with like the slipcover case. I love it.
Yeah, it's so nice. I haven't bought it yet because shipping to Canada is crazy expensive for it. And I haven't found a Canadian supplier who has it. So what is it about this book that draws you back in to read it over and over again, and to like have multiple copies of it?
There's so many reasons, but I guess to narrow it down to one specific one, I would say it would be Eleanor, the character, not the drink. She is such a complex and extremely memorable main character, and she is so distinctly Shirley Jackson. Like if anyone's ever read any other books by Shirley Jackson, she does this kind of character a lot, where she'll have very vulnerable, maybe a little unstable women kind of thrown together and then isolated in this larger than life house. And Eleanor, I think, is the most memorable because she is the most tragic.
Yeah, she's very tragic. Shirley Jackson had this really great way of writing female characters that just seem very true, very honest, and like probably pretty psychologically accurate for women of her time, you know, who didn't really necessarily feel like they probably had a lot of power or a lot of agency, and had to deal with, and we'll talk about it later, but like a character like Eleanor, who has been forced into this role of a nurse to her mother and has not experienced life because of this, and like doesn't really get respect from her family despite, you know, dealing with this arduous task of taking care of her mother while she's very ill. She is so tragic. You're right. And I think that's something that Shirley Jackson kind of carries through in a lot of her short stories. And this is the only novel by her. Have I read We've Always Lived in the Castle? I don't think I have. I own it, but I don't think I've read it.
I've read it once. I definitely think The Haunting of Hill House is much better, but it was still pretty good. And a lot of some similar themes pop up. It's definitely about these two young women who are kind of holed up in this big mansion that they've inherited, and they don't really go out. They're isolated. Yeah, it's interesting.
Well, I'm going to give a very brief kind of description of the book. This is from Goodreads, and then we'll kind of get into some talk about the book. So it is the story of four seekers who arrive at a notoriously unfriendly pile called Hill House. Dr. Montague, an occult scholar looking for solid evidence of a haunting. Theodora, the lighthearted assistant, which, I mean, I don't think she's anybody's assistant, really, but that's neither here nor there. Eleanor, a friendless, fragile young woman well acquainted with poltergeists. And Luke, the future heir of Hill House. At first, their stay seems destined to be merely a spooky encounter with inexplicable phenomena. But Hill House is gathering its powers, and soon it will choose one of them to make its own. The Haunting of Hill House was actually Shirley Jackson's fifth novel, and it was her second to last novel because she died fairly young. I think I want to say she died at 48.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Which is in itself very tragic because, I mean, she could have written like so many more stories. I don't know that she could have topped The Haunting of Hill House, but I mean, I would have loved to have read more by her. So she decided to write a ghost story after reading this story about a group of 19th century psychic researchers who had studied a house, and they reported their supposedly scientific findings to the Society for Psychic Research. As she was reading through these reports, she found not really the story of a haunted house, but basically the story of these people going in with differing motivations, differing backgrounds, who were very determined, but maybe a little misguided in trying to, you know, do this psychic research. And when you think about the motivations and the backgrounds of the people that come together in Hill House, you can totally see where she draws that inspiration. So she launches into research. She would actually sketch out the house. Like, so she sketched out the floor plans. She sketched out the exterior of the house, which is super cool. I don't know if those drawings exist anywhere, but that would be pretty neat to see.
Oh, you know me. I would kill for those sketches. I would love nothing more than to see those sketches.
It actually made me think of you when I read that. I was like, that is something that Ryan would do if he were if he were writing a book. So now I'm just going to look it up quickly. Shirley Jackson drawings, Hill House, which I should have done before. Oh, they do exist.
No fucking way.
Oh my gosh, they do.
I'm Googling it right now. Oh, that is cool.
Oh, wow. That is really cool.
I'll look at those later.
Yeah, I love that she went into that kind of detail. Like, she needed, because the house really is a character of its own. So it makes sense that she kind of sketched it out to see what it was going to look like. And one of the scariest things for me is the way that the house doesn't make sense architecturally. Like, there are things about it that shouldn't make sense. I like that she kind of drew that out to maybe like bring that more into life for herself.
Yeah, I love that. And it's not like in the House of Leaves way where it's like, wait, that closet shouldn't be there because that doesn't mathematically add up. It's just like everything is just ever so slightly off. Mm-hmm. And it actually like lends a hand to the skepticism of everything as well, because they bring up multiple times like, well, is the house really haunted? Or does it just make people feel unsettled because of how off it is? Like, there's no 90 degree corners anywhere in the house. Like, everything is just like a little bit warped. Mm-hmm. And so they bring up the possibility, well, maybe that's why all the doors swing shut. Maybe that's why people just feel unwell here. Yeah. Or maybe it is a ghost.
And then they talk about like, even in the kitchen, there's too many doors in the kitchen. They're like, why are there so many doors? But then it just makes you uneasy that there's all these access points to the kitchen when you're in there. Jackson started kind of researching haunted houses, and she claimed that she found a picture in a magazine of a house in California that she's like, this looks like a haunted house. And she was talking to her mom, and she said, you know, you live in California. Can you help me find out some more information about this house? And supposedly her mother was like, that was your great-great-grandfather's house. She also read tons of traditional ghost stories and said, no one can get into a novel about a haunted house without hitting the subject of reality head on. Either I have to believe in ghosts, which I do, or I have to write another kind of novel altogether.
Yeah, that's interesting. So with the whole thing about not knowing that the house was something that her grandfather, great grandfather had designed. Mm-hmm. And then with the next note that I see, we haven't talked about it yet, but when she awoke one morning and found something on top of her writing desk, it was a note that said with the words dead scrawled on it, written in her own handwriting. So things like that make me wonder, because Shirley Jackson came across to me as like a very funny person and witty, and it seems like she might be the type to kind of just make up fun little stories to tell people because she doesn't actually want to tell them the truth. And you know, and it comes through in her fiction, which I'm sure we'll talk about. She's very funny.
Yeah. And she even said that she didn't like talking about her books and she didn't like talking about herself. And was not somebody that kind of like a Bentley Little where she'd be like, I don't want to give interviews and, you know, talk about my writing process. And so I can see, that's a good point. Like maybe she's just being a little like tongue in cheek and being like, this is what happened. And like, it's really just because she doesn't want to talk about the book itself. So the book was published in October of 1959 by Viking Press and was a finalist for the National Book Award. In its review, the New York Times called the story, and I love this description so much, caviar for connoisseurs of the cryptic.
That alliteration is amazing.
It's so good. And then they also called her the finest master currently practicing in the genre of the cryptic haunted tale. Mm.
You should start calling your listeners that, caviar, or your podcast that, and then your listeners are the connoisseurs of the cryptic.
Ooh, I like that. That's good.
That's good.
She sold the movie rights to Hill House for $67,500, which at the time would have been huge. And actually, this helped her family feel financially stable for the first time in her life. They actually used the money from the film to buy curtains, a piano, a washing machine, and a dryer. So
I laughed when I first read that. The first thing on the list of things they bought was drapes. And I was like, girl, I feel you. If I won a bunch of money, I'd get our curtain situation sorted out ASAP. But then it also kind of just seems like a funny thing that she would say. What are you going to do with the money? I'm going to buy curtains, obviously.
Yeah. Have you seen the movie?
I have a couple times. I do.
And
I like it. Of course, I don't like it anywhere near as much as the book. The movie, it tries. Like, I think that's going in its favor, that it tries to kind of get a little more depth on Eleanor instead of just being like a goofy House on Haunted Hill style jump scare fest.
Right.
But I think I like, when we're talking about haunted house movies, I think I always gravitate more towards like the innocence.
I knew you were going to say that.
Yeah.
In 2010, critic Sophie Missing reviewed the book and said that Jackson treats her material, which could be reduced to penny dreadful stuff in less deft hands, with great skill and subtlety. The horror inherent in the novel does not lie in Hill House, monstrous though it is, or the events that take place within it, but in the unexplored recesses of its character and its readers' minds.
Totally.
This is perhaps why it remains the definitive haunted house story, which I think is 100% true, because by doing that, by making it about the psychology of the characters, it's timeless. Like, it could really take place anywhere, anytime. And I think that allows it to still be so scary.
Yeah, that's very true.
In 2018, the New York Times polled 13 writers about the scariest novel they had ever read. And two writers, Carmen Maria Machado and Neil Gaiman, both chose The Haunting of Hill House as the scariest novel they had ever read.
Nice.
Let's talk about the book itself. So we've talked a lot about the writing of the book and then the kind of impact of the book. But let's talk about the book.
Okay.
So it kind of bookends. We get the kind of whatever walked there, walked alone in kind of the opening paragraph and then in the closing paragraph.
I mean, that opening paragraph is so, so iconic. Like, everybody knows it, I think, at this point. And I see it quoted so many times. And Stephen King, take a drink, did a really, really great write-up of The Haunting of Hill House and specifically this opening and closing paragraph in his book, Danse Macabre, which is like a nonfiction kind of breakdown of popular horror media. At the time he wrote it, of course, like 1980. And he did a good job, like really making me see it in a way that I normally wouldn't, to break it down. And just talking about how like it gives you all the information you need for the entire book in this first paragraph. It's the one that says no live organism can continue for long to exist sanely, blah, 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 that paragraph. So it just immediately sets up like everything we need to know about Hill House. One, that it is not sane. You know, it's in the hills. It is haunted. Like, sure, the interesting thing about it is that Shirley Jackson doesn't leave the haunting as ambiguous as it can still be interpreted. Like, mm-hmm. everyone experiences the hauntings, not just Eleanor, but it's more about like what the house does specifically to Eleanor. And in the end, I mean, big spoiler alert, the whole line about whatever walked there walked alone, it's just genius how in the first paragraph it's like, okay, yeah, that's creepy. But in the final paragraph, it's so tragic because Eleanor is alone there.
The book starts with Dr. Montague bringing this group of people together. So we have Eleanor, who, as we've already mentioned, is this fragile, nervous young woman. She seems to have supernatural abilities. And does Carrie White's telekinetic awakening kind of feel like a callback to mm-hmm. Eleanor? Okay.
Totally.
As I was reading it, I was like, I never picked up on that before.
Yeah, they cut this out of a lot of adaptations, but there was the whole series with the stones raining down on the house in Carrie when she was just a child. And yeah, he definitely pulled inspiration from The Haunting of Hill House, especially considering Eleanor's sister's name is Carrie.
Oh, right. So that's why Dr. Montague has kind of reached out to Eleanor. Because of this incident in her childhood. Then we have Theodora, who is another young woman who has seems to have psychic abilities, and Luke, who is the heir to Hill House. Dr. Montague had reached out to a whole bunch of different people, and these were the people that got back to him. So Eleanor has not had the easiest life, and we've kind of talked about it a little bit. So her father left or died? I can't remember.
I can't remember either.
Like we mentioned, she has nursed her mother through a lengthy illness. Her mother has recently died, and Eleanor does not really have a lot of support from her sister and her brother-in-law. In fact, when she wants to go, like, it's heartbreaking to me, the scene where she has this discussion with her sister and brother-in-law about taking the car because she wants to go to Hill House. And they're like, no, you're not taking the car. Like, that's half my car. And it's just like, she has literally no agency in this story at all.
Yeah. I think that's a super, super important thing. And the way I see it is that she is consistently infantilized throughout the entire novel. Mm-hmm. Like, even before the novel starts, when she talks about taking care of her mother, I don't think it's just that her mother was sick. I think that she just had a really bad relationship with her mother.
Yeah.
And then having to give away 11 years of her life, what should be, you know, prime years of her life, going to college, starting a family, mm-hmm. whatever it is she would want to do. She didn't get to do any of that because she was still under her mother's thumb. And then sleeping in her sister's baby's room just on a cot. And I mean, she's literally being placed in the nursery. That's how overt it is. I'm just realizing. And then they're always, and it's not just that they won't let her have the car. They're like, well, we won't expect you to bring it back in good condition. You'll mess it up. You can't handle driving this car. And it's so sad.
So we learned that Hill House was built by the wealthy Hugh Crane. And Hugh did not have the best of luck with wives. I think he had two wives. Both of them died in the house, I believe. And the house's history is riddled with violent deaths. There's been suicide. Other people have died as well. And there are two caretakers. So there's Mr. and Mrs. Dudley. And Mrs. Dudley in particular is, I feel like, a little bit of comic relief.
Oh, yeah.
And they are very protective of the house, but also very scared of the house. And they absolutely refuse to stay after after dark, to the point where Mrs. Dudley reiterates again and again and again, I set the table at this time, I clear the table at this time, and then I'm done. I don't stay after dark. Like,
no one will hear you in the dark, in the night.
It's so creepy.
No one will come if you're screaming.
So Dr. Montague's goal is to prove the existence of ghosts. That's why he's brought them all together. And it isn't long before things start happening. So we've already talked about this. Everything is off with the house, but just slightly. Like, dimensions seem wrong. Doors close suddenly. There are strange noises. There are cold patches in the house. And things, as they do, get worse. So we have blood appearing on Theodora's clothing. There's writing on the walls. There's banging on the doors in the middle of the night.
Mm-hmm. I think it might be interesting to talk here about how quickly Eleanor and Theo become like inseparable. It's like the minute they meet, they become almost like sisters. And Theo even says like, oh, I'm sure we have the same uncle somewhere or something. We're practically family. And they're joining arms and they're planning, you know, to have picnics. And they're just like, oh, we're going to rule this house. We're going to wear our most fashionable clothes and brighten up these rooms. And it's,
yeah, before anybody else even arrives, they're already like,
yeah, definitely
like best buddies. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I can see why that happens from Eleanor's perspective, because for Eleanor, here's somebody who's treating her like a normal human being. And this is her first shot at freedom in her adult life. Mm-hmm. So I can see her like instantly latching onto someone who is nice to her. But like Theo has a completely, seemingly, I should say, we don't know, but she seems to have a relatively happy life despite her leaving her apartment after a argument with her roommate, who I think is,
I shouldn't say I think. Specified gender.
But Theo is seen as kind of a, like a lesbian icon, right? So.
Well, yeah, it's so interesting because I believe, I could be wrong, but I think Shirley Jackson had denied that when she was alive and was like, oh, no, really? I don't appreciate people saying that there's homosexuality in my stories, blah, blah, blah. But it seems to be like, this is not a new thought that's come out like in the age of wokeness or whatever, because in the film adaptation, which came out just a couple years after the novel was published, the director himself was even like, yeah, we filmed this whole scene where Theo breaks up with her girlfriend and there's like, you know, nasty words written in lipstick and everything. And he literally said we had to cut the lesbian scene because they wouldn't go for it. But it's there. I think if you want to find it, I might be in the minority in that I think it's less evident in the book than it is in the original film adaptation. There's a scene, there's such a good scene where Theo and Eleanor are fighting and she says, you know, you think that they're talking about Theo's psychic powers, but what they're really talking about is her being a lesbian. And Eleanor is saying something like, oh, you would know all about nature's mistakes. You're one of them. And yes. Theo is like just hurt and shocked. And so I think it's there. But I was going to ask you, what do you think Theo is really as psychic as they make her out to be?
No, I don't. I think, I mean, do we see any evidence of it in the book? I feel like we don't. The only thing they talk about is the, like the test or the experiment that she was a part of.
Yeah.
Where she was able to predict what was going to happen next. I think they were doing cards.
I go back and forth, because like that thing with the cards and everything and how she passed the test, it does seem like, oh, well, maybe she is, but it also seems a lot like maybe she just can read Eleanor like an open book, because that's kind of what Eleanor is in the house. She wears her heart on her sleeve and she frankly comes across really desperate. So, you know, there's this great moment too in the book where they're touring the house. They're about to go into the library and Eleanor stops and she's like, oh, I can't go in there. My mother. And they're like, well, what's going on? And she's like, it's the smell of, you know, her mother's sick room or whatever.
Yeah.
Which she doesn't tell them, but then later on in the book, Theo is like, well, what are you getting angry with me for? I don't think you killed your mother. And it's just like, this is, everyone just kind of stops. So I don't know. I go back and forth on it, but I do think it's an interesting relationship dynamic because, as we know, Eleanor lies through her teeth to all of these people And Theo kind of like subtly calls her on it sometimes. Like, so tell me about this apartment you have.
Yeah. Yeah. Because that's the one thing she does. Like she has imagined this whole life for herself. And in fact, she talks about one of the most heartbreaking scenes for me is like, so at the beginning, she's like driving because she ends up basically absconding with the family car. And she stops in this kind of cafe diner sort of thing. And she sees a little girl who is very upset because she doesn't have her cup with the stars in it. She is very much like, don't let them take your cup with the stars. Like, so she like, don't let them take your happiness from you, essentially is what she's saying. And your joy. And then she incorporates that into her, like she has the, like she has this cottage and or whatever, and she has a white cat and she's got the cup with the stars, and she just takes like little bits of life to try and create this happy life for herself. And it's just,
yeah,
it's so sad.
I'm glad you brought up that scene, because I was gonna have to rewind us and go back there at some point, because that's one of my favorite sections of the whole book before they even get to Hill House, is that whole sequence with Eleanor driving and everywhere she passes by, she imagines like an entire life for herself.
Yeah.
Like you said. And that's very sad. And it's also kind of very telling about where she's at emotionally, because she's doing something for the first time in her life. And she doesn't have a place in her own life, in her own world. She doesn't really have a place. So when she gets to Hill House, which is, as we learn in the first paragraph, not sane, it's not good. And it, you know, it wants to consume fragile personalities like that. And poor Eleanor, she has no place in the world. So she instantly just gloms onto these people. And then eventually it turns into glomming onto the house. And it's really sad that way.
And you're right. Like, it's like she, even despite all these horrible things that are happening, and there's some genuinely scary things that happen, she doesn't want to leave. Like, eventually she's like, I don't want to leave. Like, this, I feel like I'm home. Like, I feel like I belong here, despite, you know, the writing on the walls and, or I'm going to save this scene until we talk about some of our favorite things in the book, because it's sheer perfection to me. Yeah. And it's so well written. Anyways, so she definitely seems to be the target of the house's malice, I guess. She experiences more than any of the others. And at first you kind of like, is it in their head? Is it like, is this like, are they open to suggestion because of these things that are happening, and particularly with her? But then more and more stuff starts happening, and more of them are, they're experiencing it in tandem. So you know that it isn't necessarily in their head. But do you think that the house, because things like obviously amplify, they keep getting worse and worse and worse. Do you think the house is kind of feeding off of Eleanor's fragility, and that's like powering it up kind of thing? Like she's like a battery for the house?
Yeah, I do think that that's probably playing into it. And I think you could read this book both ways, with it being like, this house is actually evil, that it is actually this force, or you could read it as it's all Eleanor. Either she is causing these paranormal things to happen, or she is just imagining most of this happening, or doing it herself. I think you could read it both ways and be right. I choose to read it the first way, that Eleanor is just a very tragic, unstable, emotionally ungrounded person. And she just happened to cross paths with something that feeds on that sort of weakness perfectly, which it doesn't take away any of the tragedy or the poignancy of it to me. So yeah, I definitely think that's probably the way I tend to read it, is that, you know, the house is, she's feeding it, it's feeding on her, you know, that sort of thing. A lot like The Shining, even, because I think the whole thing with The Shining was that it was feeding off Danny's powerful, you know, waves he was giving off.
Yeah. So maybe like similarly, like she does have those psychic abilities or some, not psychic abilities, because she's more like got this kind of telekinetic thing going on, I guess, or something going on, and that kind of powers the house. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
And what do you think of the other characters? Like, so we have like Dr. Montague. We talked a little bit about Theo, who I always just imagine as being the most glamorous person. Like she just seems like she's like this, like, and in the 1960, I think it's 1961, the Haunting. She's perfectly cast. Like
she's so good.
And Luke. So what do you think of those, the main characters?
Okay. So this is not an original idea to me. This is something I read about at one point, but then I was kind of like, you know, somebody tells you something about a book and then you're looking for it while you read. Mm-hmm. So all of these characters do have something surprising in common, which is that they do not have a typical family life. So we know about Eleanor and the whole thing with her family. And Theo mentions at one point that she spent her summers at an empty boarding school, claiming that she did not really have a relationship with her parents or they were too busy for her. There's a couple times when Luke mentions that he never had a real mother and he doesn't really know about Eleanor's past, but at one point says he says, "You're so lucky you had a mother." And it's just kind of like this awful, shouldn't have said that.
Yeah. He's been raised more or less by his aunt, right? Who actually is the one that currently owns Hill House.
Yeah. And then there's even Dr. Montague and his wife. There's a brief mention about how he never had the chance to have children. So they all have this weird thing with family. And I, from what I understand, Shirley Jackson did not have a really great relationship with her mother. It wasn't always bad, but it was always pretty strained.
Yeah.
And there are some interesting themes about the house kind of symbolizing these absent mothers, which is just so weird. But I'm going to skip ahead to quotes really quick because I jotted a couple down. Theo says at one point, "They simply wallowed in this kind of great billowing overdone sort of thing and buried themselves in folds of velvet and tassels and purple plush." That's a really vaginal way to describe a house, I think.
No, 100%. 100%.
And then later Luke says, you know, Hill House is a mother house. Everything's so soft, everything's so padded, great embracing chairs and sofas, which turn out to be hard and unwelcome when you sit down and reject you at once.
Ooh.
So that's kind of weird. And, you know, it's because Eleanor was essentially running away from her mother and all the guilt and rage and, you know, anger and sadness over that whole situation with her mom. But in the end, she just kind of ends up running back to that.
And I mean, they really do personify the house, like, because even, you know, they talk about the house. The face of Hill House seemed awake with a watchfulness from the blank windows and a touch of glee in the eyebrow of a cornice. Like, this house is a person. It is as much a character as anyone else, I feel like.
Oh, yeah. It's so beautifully described.
Okay. So speaking of Dr. Montague and his family, what is the deal with Arthur? So I should preface this. So Arthur, Mrs. Montague and her friend Arthur show up. Like, I think on the weekend they show up randomly and everyone else has kind of lost track of the days as well. Everything's kind of blurring together. So they're kind of surprised, even though Dr. Montague knew that she was coming on the weekend, they're kind of caught off guard when they do show up. But what is the deal with Arthur? Because he's kind of this dick of a character.
Well, I think Arthur is driving more than Mrs. Montague's car, if you know what I mean. They're throwing it back on the side while Dr. Montague's off studying ghosts. You know that's what's going on.
Yeah, I think so. It's so weird that she just brings him to the house, though.
She's the same way. She like basically steps in for maybe Dr. Montague's mother or something. She infantilizes everyone.
That's true. That's true. And she is the one that is very overtly like kind of spiritual into the mystical world. And she's like, "We're going to ask Planchette about this." And she uses a Planchette to ask the house questions. She thinks that Planchette, I believe, is speaking about Eleanor at one point, right?
Yeah, where it says something like mother, home, come home, home, home.
Yeah. Well, should we talk about the ending?
Yeah, let's do it. I mean, there's still a lot more to say after we get to the ending. I'm kind of waiting for us to talk about the ending so that way we can really just dive into what it all is.
Okay, do you want to give a quick recap of what happens at the end?
Well, Eleanor loses her sweet mind. She is fully into the house. So she starts running all over the place. Full disclosure, it's been a little while since I've read it. Because I did listen to it when we talked about doing this, and then we rescheduled a few times. So it's not super fresh, but that's essentially what happens. She goes insane and she's like, I'm never going to leave this house. I belong here. You cannot make me leave. I will not leave. And everyone else is like, okay, it's time. And there's so much that we still need to talk about with their whole, how Eleanor got to this point. But they're like, we're sending you home. You can't be here. It's not safe for you to be here. You're not well. So they get her in the car and she says something. I think Luke was going to drive her, but she was like, oh, Luke, will you go grab something? And then she takes off and she intentionally drives headfirst into a tree, which is how I think one of Hugh Crane's wives died. And she basically kills herself. And the like we said earlier, that first paragraph kind of repeats with just minor changes that implies that, well, Eleanor kind of got what she wanted. She is secluded. She's, you know, cut off. She lives in that house now and she's walking there alone.
It's incredible. It's like, you just want this happy ending for her because you're like, this woman deserves a happy ending.
I don't know. And also it's like, Her spiral is kind of, you know, she's already kind of on that path by the time the book starts. So it's almost like I never imagined a happy ending for her, I think, the first time I read the book, which sucks. But yeah, it's not in a carry way where you're kind of like rooting for her the whole time. It's a lot more sad. And that, like,
I feel like you're mourning her lost potential more than anything. Yes,
the fact that she never had a chance.
Let's talk about what led up to that point. So there's basically this scene where she basically is like in mortal danger. Like she, at one point, I think she's climbing up the stairs. And if you've seen The Haunting of Hill House, the Mike Flanagan Netflix series, they've got that, like that beautiful, like spiral staircase that just looks very unsafe. So she goes up on that and she's like leaning backwards, like almost to the point where she's going to fall because she's just lost in her imagination. And they have to kind of try and coax her down. The staircase is so rickety that it cannot hold the weight of more than one person. And it's already dangerous that she's on it. So that's kind of, I think, the breaking point for everyone else to be like, all right, we need to like stop this now because you are going to get hurt. And they all see what's happening to her. This isn't explicitly said, but I think she starts to imagine things. Like we talked about her kind of imagining having this imaginary life, but she starts to imagine other things happening. Like I think she imagines at one point something's going on between Luke and Theo, and I don't think there really is. I think she also then thinks at one point that like Luke is kind of like attracted to her.
Yeah.
And that's not really happening. So she starts, like all of these things start happening that aren't really happening. So they're clearly seeing all of this. And this is kind of the final straw where they're like, you need to get out of this house because it is having a very unhealthy effect on you.
Yeah. I do want to talk about the way she perceives everyone around her is so interesting because like we said earlier, immediately when she meets Theo, they become like attached at the hip, but it goes sour very, very quickly. And it's because Eleanor is so, it's almost like it's all a joke that she's not in on, if that makes sense.
100%.
They all gather in this house and they kind of start pretending, like play acting, that they're this weird family because Dr. Montague is so fatherly and he's like, oh, settle down, kids. And they're just like, tell us a story. And it's very weird like that, but it's almost like they all know it's an act, but Eleanor doesn't because she has no frame of reference for any of that. She wakes up every day and she's like, I'm a part of this group. These are my friends and I love them so much. And then it gets creepy at a certain point because she even starts talking about how like when this experiment's over, she wants to go follow Theo and live near her and they're going to work together and they're going to go shopping together. And Theo shuts her down. She's like, no, I'm going to go back to my life. You need to go back to your life. Mm-hmm. And Eleanor is like, well, nobody wants me anywhere. I don't have anything to go to.
Yeah.
So it escalates. And that whole thing that you were talking about with how she starts to perceive that maybe she likes Luke, but she really doesn't. Mm-hmm. And then she starts to perceive that Luke and Theo are flirting and she doesn't like that. And it almost felt to me like Luke and Theo were doing that sarcastically just to mess with her. Mm. Or, and I can't tell. I can never tell. It's like, is that what was really happening? Or is that just me like being in Eleanor's head and that's what she thinks?
See, that's kind of how I imagine Luke and Theo as just kind of like, you know, having like a normal banter that mm-hmm. like adults will have. And then Eleanor not being like used to those kind of interactions, thinking that they are either making fun of her or that they're genuinely like flirting with each other. Like that's how I kind of interpreted it, was that it was just all because of her social anxiety and her social isolation where she didn't grow up having those relationships.
Yeah.
She totally misreads everything.
So what was the scene that you said you really wanted to talk about? One of the creepy scenes.
Oh my gosh. So it's a scene where, I want to say it's about halfway through the book and, it's prior to any of the, I think it's after the first time. So at one point at night, Theo and Eleanor are in the room, and I think are they in the same room at the time? They end up in the same room eventually.
Because the rooms are like joined together by the bathroom. So
they hear like a banging, like going down the hall. So it's after that. And so basically they're in bed and they're like kind of like using each other as like comfort, right? So that sounds bad. That sounds like they're just kind of like close to each other, or mm-hmm. you think that they're close to each other, and the banging starts and it's dark and Eleanor is just like holding onto Theo's hand and she's just holding on. And this is the only comfort she has. She's like, I'm good. I'm okay. I'm going to get through this, basically. And then Theo is actually across the room.
Whose hand was I holding?
Oh my God. It's so scary. It's just...
It's great.
It's so good. And I know it's something... It's not necessarily something that is particularly surprising. Like we've read that before. One of my favorite stories growing up, like when I was reading like, you know, scary stories for kids, was the one about the person who would like, was when they would get scared at night, they would put their hand down and their dog would lick their hand and they knew everything was okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What's a no dog?
Oh God. It just, it speaks to that same kind of vibe for me where I'm just like, nope, nope, nope. You can just imagine like, oh my God, I'm okay. I'm okay because somebody else is here with me. I'm holding on tight. And like, as long as I hold on to this person, I'm okay. And then you realize that your comfort was false and that it was not that person. And that means that somebody else or something else was in the room with you holding your hand.
Yeah. One moment shortly before that I really like, when they first hear the banging, mm-hmm. Eleanor, because one thing it talks about a lot is how she would always dread and hate the sound of her mother hitting the wall with her cane because she needed help with something while she was taking care of her. Yeah. So when the banging starts at Hill House, Eleanor is like half asleep and she's like, oh, mother, I hear you. I'm coming. I'm coming. And one of the big things is that Eleanor does feel some guilt because I think, you know, one time her mother was knocking for help and Eleanor didn't go, or at least that's implied. Like she just kind of, like, I'll deal with that later. She's driving me crazy, and then realizes that she died. So I thought it was really creepy when Eleanor was like, oh, mother, stop hitting the wall. I'm on my way. And then she kind of opens her eyes and she realizes she's in Hill House. And it's just like, oh, all that bad shit with her mom just kind of comes flooding back.
Mm-hmm. I just think that those scenes, like that, there aren't a lot of them. They're like, the book is not riddled with really, really scary scenes, but the ones that there are just so well written and they're so well done. And like, one of the quotes that I really liked was about one of the times when like the banging was happening, and then it took, little paddings came from around the door frame, small seeking sounds, feeling the edges of the door, trying to sneak away in. The doorknob was fondling, and Eleanor whispering, ask, is it locked? And Theodora nodded. And just like the idea of like something trying to find its way in.
Yeah,
that's great. And like seeing the doorknob, it's so good.
A lot of the horror too, I think, comes when, because like you said, not a whole lot super intense happens. Like we said, it's not just like, you know, jump scares and ghostly occurrences every few pages. But I feel like whenever I read, it's always uneasy because whenever something does happen, Eleanor's like spiral into just becoming more mentally unwell. It's always like, what's her reaction going to be? How is this going to send her over the edge? Mm-hmm. And she does become like a little more just rattled every time, because it does seem like the house is starting to tailor its actions directly towards her, and it gets what it wants in the end. I was also going to say, when we talked about the ending, how it's kind of cyclical, because that was how Hugh Crane's wife died, and there was this whole sub story with like these sisters fighting over the stuff in Hill House. And that was kind of echoing Eleanor and her sister fighting over the car and everything. So
I was going to say, even like Eleanor and Theo's relationship devolving as well.
Oh,
like,
yeah, totally. Yeah.
Yeah. That's such a weird little subplot, like with the sisters, and one of them was sneaking into the one that didn't get the house was sneaking in and stealing the china.
Yeah.
But I think it just speaks to the idea of this house being poisonous and just like breaking relationships. And like just kind of infecting people with its malicious intent.
Yeah, it's really sad. And it just, the way that it specifically preys on her weakness too makes it all the more malicious, because, you know, after everyone else rejects her, they want to send her packing, and, you know, she has no anchor, no agency, no independence. So she just kind of, she's like, okay, well, the house wants me, so I'm just going to do what the house wants me to do.
What are kind of your favorite things about the book, would you say?
Man, I feel like we talked about a lot of them.
We really did.
No, there's Eleanor, of course. And we talk a lot about our favorite character in the Stephen King world, Holly Gibney. And I think that there's some parallels to be made there. Whereas, you know, the opposite is true for Holly Gibney. She actually does kind of become more grounded over time and take control of her life. The whole tragedy of that, it's weird to say that that's like my favorite part of the book, but it is the most compelling. And I just mean the way Shirley Jackson kills it. She knows what she's doing with words. We talk so much about how this is, you know, such an emotional book that everything means something else. But when you get down to it, the way that she describes this house and the way she describes the creepy things happening in it are just, they're just so good. Mm-hmm. There's that, the quote that I accidentally mentioned earlier, one of my favorites describing the house, it goes, "No human eye can isolate the unhappy coincidence of line and place, which suggests evil in the face of a house. And yet somehow a maniac juxtaposition, a badly turned angle, some chance meeting of roof and sky turned Hill House into a place of despair. More frightening because the face of Hill House seemed awake with a watchfulness from the blank windows and a touch of glee in the eyebrow of a cornice. This house, which seemed somehow to have formed itself, flying together into its own powerful pattern under the hands of its builders, fitting itself into its own construction of lines and angles, reared its great head back against the sky without concession to humanity." Like, girl just killed it.
Yeah. Man, like it just kind of encapsulates everything that like makes Hill House terrifying, I feel like.
Yeah. And I feel like anyone who reads this book has such a vivid picture, at least I do in my head, of what Hill House looks like. But it's also like nothing that a real house would ever look like. Like I could never draw it, but I see it in my head. It's just like this weird squatting, just monster of a building.
I love the way it starts out. Fairly, I don't want to say slow. It doesn't start out slow. It starts, everything that happens at the beginning is quite subtle. And then it just gets worse and worse and worse, which is typical of any horror novel, really.
Yeah.
But I think just the way that it's done and the way that it is written, like that's how you feel as well reading it. Like you start out and you're like, oh, this is like a nice cozy read. And then it gets, and you're like, oh, this is sad. And you feel bad for Eleanor. And then you just get tense. Like, I know when I read it, like usually the last 100 pages, I just read in like a big like spurt because I just want to finish it. And I like just feel like I tense up as I'm reading it. And which is to me a great testimonial to the power of Shirley Jackson's writing.
Yeah. And also because I think towards the beginning of the book, she uses a lot of her great humor. We were talking about how funny she is earlier, and a lot of the banter that they have at the beginning when they're just kind of like getting to know each other, it really sets you up for what you think is going to be like a cozy, fun, haunted house tale. Yeah. And then it keeps kind of spiraling. And I think she's really skilled with the way she kind of pulls back on certain elements to just heighten the tension.
Mm-hmm. You know, the first half of the book, you don't expect the tragedy that is going to end the book. Like you don't see that mm-hmm. happen. But as it gets closer and closer to the end, you can see that, you know, you can see that things are going to go horribly wrong for Eleanor in particular. And I think to your point, you said earlier that you didn't anticipate that she would have a happy ending. I shouldn't say that I didn't think she would have a happy ending. I didn't think she would have that ending. I think the first time I read it, right. Where I was like, I just want her to go and like leave the house and like tell her sister and her brother-in-law, I'm out. Like you do your life. I'm going to do mine. But I mean, clearly that was never destined for her. So
yeah. Yeah. Another thing, too, that I wanted to bring up is how usually in these types of stories, we know well that they kind of have the and then there were none, because usually whatever happens, it'll pick mm-hmm. someone off. Someone will get scared and flee the house. Someone might die. And so usually it kind of goes in that formulaic pattern. And I really like that it doesn't here. And I think that just makes it even all the more sad for Eleanor's ending, that everyone is kind of just there every step of the way. And it doesn't really seem to be quite as bad for any of them except for Eleanor.
Yeah, it really isn't. Like none of them are as susceptible to the house's influence as she is.
Yeah. And I think, I can't remember, I might have to pull up the Kindle version real quick, but I feel like there's a couple paragraphs at the very end of the book that basically just talk about how these other people just went back to their lives. And it wasn't so for Eleanor.
Yeah. Like, I think they talk about Theo, like going back and like making up with her roommate. It's insane. They all just kind of go on with life and things are okay for them. Eleanor doesn't get that, which is...
That made it very sad.
Yeah. All right. Anything else about the Haunting of Hill House? I almost called it
House on Haunted
House Hill. House on Haunted Hill.
just that there's one scene that I think kind of plays into the whole theme I brought up earlier about the whole motherhood and broken mm-hmm. families. And that's when Eleanor and Theo, I think they argue about something and then they leave the house. And they see something, Theo sees something that is so terrifying that it's never even described to us. But part of what they both see is like this, it's almost just like a family picnic, but they're ghosts, right?
Yeah.
So I thought that was kind of interesting and weird, especially that something happens that's so terrifying that not even Eleanor knows what it is.
Yeah, I didn't even think about that. That's true.
I mean, it's one of those scenes that happens so fast that I can't like remember the exact details of it after the fact. But
you're right. She just says like I can't remember if she says run or like let's just keep walking or what. But she's like, but don't look back.
That was interesting. But other than that, I think that's about it. Such a good story. I hope that anyone who hasn't read it will just read it and then read it again, because I think it's one of those books where you get so much more. I mean, literally every time I read it, there's some new angle that I didn't know about before. Yeah. And that's why I think Shirley Jackson is so enduring.
There's some subtleties that she sneaks in there for sure. Yeah. If you haven't read it and you have seen the Mike Flanagan series, do not expect it to be anything like it, because it's really a very, very loose interpretation. You can probably tell from listening to this that it's very different than that. But I highly recommend this book. It's kind of the perfect book to read in October as well.
Yeah. It's usually one of my October traditions. Like I'll read this book every single year. The only reason I'm not mm-hmm. doing it this year is because, well, one, I'm too busy. And two, I read it earlier this year already when the illustrated edition came out. So
speaking of which, what are you reading for spooky season?
Well, unfortunately not much, because like I said, I've been really busy lately. I just finished reading Tome by Ross Jeffrey, and I'm about to start the next book in that trilogy, which is called Scorched, I think. And the reason I'm reading those is because I'm illustrating them for the new editions. So Yay. Look those up. And you know, I picked up Hell House by Richard Matheson. I picked it up off the shelf the other day because it's a very good October read. And I got through a chapter and then I was like, I started feeling guilty that I wasn't reading The Dark Tower. So I was like, oh, I should put this down.
That's going to be my next read, I think, actually, after I finish. I'm reading Dead Leaves by, why can't I never remember his name?
Galen Patrick Burke.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah.
So I'm reading that right now, which is great. It's 9 short stories set around Halloween, and they're fantastic. I think I have 2 more stories left to read, and then I will be done it. But it's also really – I love at the end he's got a list of books that he recommends and then movies that he recommends. And I mean, they are lists. Like, they're very comprehensive.
Cool.
So lots of different recommendations that he makes that I have not read or seen. So I'll have to like check that out. But I think I was going to read Hell House next because I have not read that. And I feel like it is kind of the perfect October read.
Yeah, Hell House is good. It's very similar to Hill House, but just more in the classic. It's more of like a fun haunted house story than an emotional, tragic one. But I just forgot. I was going to tell you, I checked out The Hunger by Alma Katsu on Libby today.
Ooh.
Because I really want to read it, but who knows if I will. We'll see.
Okay, well, thanks for joining us today. Ryan, where can our listeners find you on social media?
Twitter is the only place, well, the best place, because that's probably the one I'm most active at. That is OrionM642.
I don't think – have we talked about it on here that we started another podcast?
I think we may have mentioned it, yeah. But we can always mention it again. For those of you who love it when we bring up Stephen King, Sherry and I have decided that we are going to take on the Castle Rock Book Club, elevate it into its new final form. So we're going back through all those books plus a lot more, and we are making those intricate Stephen King connections a lot easier for new listeners, new readers to understand. So it's basically a Stephen King podcast where we kind of examine the connectedness of all of his books. So that's a lot of fun. And it's also just, you know, fun talking about his books because there are some great ones in there to dissect. And that is the Castle Rock Book Club, out now.
You can catch us on Twitter at Cat Scaredy and on Instagram at Scaredy Cats the Podcast. Subscribe wherever you find podcasts. And don't forget to let us know what you think by leaving us a review. Love to hear what you're reading right now as well. But until next time, stay scared. Happy Halloween.
Bye.